In Session with Dr. Farid Holakwi.
Good evening, welcome to In Session. I'm your host, Dr. Farid Holakwi, and I'll be with you for the next hour here on Radio Hamra. Student number, call in 310-441-0555. You can follow me on Twitter or Instagram or like my page on Facebook to get updates on the show or suggest topics or books for the program. And the shows are uploaded at the end of each week to my SoundCloud page and podcast on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Let's get to the books of the week. The book of the week for this week that I'll talk about on next Monday's show is The Menopause Brain by Lisa Mascagni. The Menopause Brain, New Science Empowers Women to Navigate the Pivotal Transition with Knowledge and Confidence. Always trying to understand different aspects of the human experience, and I've actually heard many commentators talk about how menopause is not very well understood by medical doctors even, but let alone mental health professionals, about potential changes or challenges that might come about during this transition. So wanted to inform myself more on this topic. So The Menopause Brain by Lisa Mascagni. The book of the week from last week that I'll be talking about tonight is Imagination, A Manifesto by Ruha Benjamin. And this is, I believe, the third book of Dr. Benjamin's that I've covered on the show, Race After Technology and Viral Justice, both of which I greatly enjoyed. So when I saw she had a new book, wanted to check it out. And this one also did not disappoint. And I'll get into the book, of course, but an overview of just some thoughts on the book, even this theme, imagination, that she describes about how we have created the world, and the world has been created by so many different factors. But a big part of it is based on imaginations or theories or ideas that come about that end up becoming part of the fabric of the society and of the world we live in. And often when things are a certain way, we think they have to be that way. It's natural for it to be that way, that it can't be any other way. But in a way, this book is inviting us to imagine differently, that so often things that we thought were impossible became possible, or so often revolution seemed impossible. I think there's a quote I read or heard one time about revolutions, that they seem impossible until they seem inevitable, or something along those lines, that when we look at a system, it seems so powerful, whether that's a system of government or a regime, or how things are done in a particular country, the system seems so strong, you think, how is it possible to change it? But tiny changes over time, and that's a theme in Dr. Benjamin's book, Viral Justice, or one of the main themes, tiny changes over time can go viral and be contagious, and over time create a huge movement, change, revolution. And so we must not fear dreaming and imagining. And just because something seems far-fetched, or people will tell you, oh, you can't change that, or that can't be done, to not be dissuaded by that. And it doesn't mean just dream and dream alone, or imagine things. Oh, it'd be so nice if it was like this. I'm not someone who thinks of manifesting as working in the sense that I can just imagine something better for myself or the world, and just my imagining and thinking is enough. It's going to take action. It's going to take change being done in the here and now. But without that imagination, without that plan, and then without that hope, we can't make that change. So we can't deny ourselves, or we shouldn't deny ourselves, that room to imagine. But as she shares, not everyone gets to imagine equally. When we think about the world we have created and the world we will continue to create in the future, there are definitely some voices, and that's groups of people, who get to imagine more comfortably and to get their imaginations heard, and specific individuals within those groups that really get to have their imaginations heard, or get to even create that future for us. And we often are just bystanders to what they create. And she brings us up throughout the book. We see tech billionaires, for example, who are creating the current, present very clearly, but also making the plans for the future, and including things like possibly going to other planets or leaving Earth and creating civilizations elsewhere, rather than at times focusing on problems that are right here, right in front of us. People are suffering today that we can help today, but instead we are thinking about how to create a civilization on Mars and at some time. And so there can be imagination that happens there, but I would think we should direct resources to the here and now, to the real suffering that's happening today, rather than just on these potential threats in the future, ideas in the future. And clearly, what's being said by that is the people that are suffering now are not as valuable as even these potential future selves of a group and groups that are more important, more significant. So, dreaming is something, and imagination is something that should be democratized. I forgot where that was in the book, but that theme is throughout the book, that everyone should have the space to dream and imagine and to contribute to the future. When we think about the impossible, she talks about the military budget in the United States and how it's bigger than the next, I don't know if it's like 7, 8, many of the next biggest countries when it comes to military spending. And if that wasn't the case, I was looking up some numbers. It's around, I saw some estimates, around $1 trillion that the United States spends on the government annually. I saw something around 766, one number 877. I think that was for 2022. Regardless, some very big number around $1 trillion. But if it was $100 billion, and I told you, hey, we want to raise the military spending another $700-800 billion, you would likely say, oh, that's impossible. We don't have the money for that. And yet we do it. So I really, really was very heartwarming, and not just in an emotional, that's nice way, but really encouraging, I should say, and even more than that, hearing her giving voice to this thought that we shouldn't be afraid to dream big and imagine very different futures from what we currently experience. And that to make sure we are taking care of one another and being very aware of the, although it was imagination, the ideologies also that are creating our present world that, as I said before, seem like human nature. That's something you hear a lot, and I'll touch on that, that it comes up later in the book. What human nature is often used as a reason why things are the way they are. Human nature, or then also this is how men are, this is how women are, that's nature or natural, this is how even different races are. We often are told these messages and fed these messages that become part of reality when they are just ideas that people have and misguided ones. Early in the book, she shares some different narratives that have had substantial negative impacts on the world and how things played out, and giving just a few of them. One was the doctrine of discovery. I actually did not know about this one. It's a principle of international law that was from a papal decree by the Catholic Church in 1493, which essentially said that Christians could seize and colonize any land they found occupied by non-Christians, which means that they doing anything, essentially the land belongs to you, not to them or anyone who is there. Similarly, in the United States, the next one listed here is Manifest Destiny, which is it was coined in 1845 and essentially said that the white settlers could take all the land they wanted, going west and killing all the natives and the indigenous people that they encountered, essentially that it was their land. They weren't taking anything that wasn't already theirs. It was essentially God-given. And then also survival of the fittest is listed here, and that's an interesting one. And I've heard takes on this and different accounts on how it's a very westernized conception of survival, that it's just about the individual being the most fit and greedy and selfish. And this relates to the book I talked about last week, Purpose by Samuel Wilkinson, looking at human nature and these conflicting dual potentials of human nature, but that possibly this notion we have of survival of the fittest being so individualistic, when we look at the human species, there might be more of an emphasis or importance we should place on interdependence rather than on independence, which is this Western ideal and focus that often loses sight of our interdependence with each other and also with our environment. That's something that we have lost very starkly in the United States and a lot of the Western mindset, unfortunately, and we pay the price for it, and the world pays the price. Unfortunately, the people that often pay the price are the ones who don't get to even enjoy the benefits as much, which is heartbreaking and been chronicled by many, how things like climate change affect the poorest individuals and the poorest countries more than the ones who are doing the polluting and creating and causing the most damage. So it opens with some of these different narratives, and in that way invites us to think of different narratives or recognize there can be different narratives. And similar to Viral Justice, where she shares so many examples of people who are doing these, starting small, but of course they often grow, but starting small to make a difference and make a change towards justice. She shares many individuals and groups throughout the book who are doing similarly with this theme of imagining different types of futures, of trying to not buy in to the narratives that already exist in our world and to recognize that maybe there's a different possibility for us. Even I think there was a term, homo cooperativus, basically a play on homo economicus, which is that this idea that human beings, all they're trying to do is maximize their wealth or their money or goods. But often we see that that is not playing out in how people actually make decisions. And so maybe we're actually more born to be cooperative. Again, this theme of interdependence comes up. And as I was saying, something about human nature that I really liked, this is later in the book, that how important it is what we consider human nature. And so if we think people are bad, people are selfish and greedy, we're going to create a world that then reflects that, but that doesn't have to be the case. So here it says, we must take seriously competing theories of human nature: individualistic, competitive, self-maximizing mammals, or interdependent, cooperative, communal creatures. And so if we recognize that, even if you might think there is dual aspects or we are complex, but that we also have a big part of us, and really to survive long-term and to survive long-term in our environment, we need to focus on this interdependent, cooperative, and communal side of us, and how different it would be if we focus on that aspect of who we are and who we can be and the kind of world we should create. And looking again at these different ideologies and perspectives on human nature and how they impact what we decide to do, often we see human beings as bad unless we punish them or if we create fear, and inherently bad. And so she shares here that when we look at how to make things better, sometimes, unfortunately, what we end up doing is we see politicians just thinking, well, we need more police and we need more policing to make the world safer, rather than addressing what is causing the majority of the crime and the harm, which is people not having enough of what they basically need. So here it says, fact is, research piled high shows that investment in public services like guaranteed basic income, summer jobs programs, housing support, and healthcare access is much more effective at making communities safe because it addresses people's fundamental needs. These two options, investing in punishment versus investing in people, represent distinct policy alternatives and also radically different imaginations. And this really struck me, that I think is really powerful, especially that part, investing in punishment versus investing in people. And I think sadly, what we often see is an investment, more investments in punishment, and thinking that's going to lead to peace, whether it's with domestically or internationally, that you just punish people that are bad, and even who you label as bad, of course, involves its own imaginations. But that's going to be the way we get to peace or calm, which it never is. And so if we have people who are suffering, who don't have their basic needs met, there's going to be an increase in crime. We see that happening. But if we, as she states here, invest in public services, then we are going to have more peace, more safety in our community, and it's the more humane thing to do. It's also what we must do. And so, again, there's notions in this part of the book looking at how our survival is based on cooperation and collaboration in managing resources, rather than in trying to create a world that only benefits some and not all of us. So it's a great, great read. I hope you will check it out. It really shows you what it means that imagination is creating the world that we live in, but also how we must imagine for a different world. And we must not be afraid to imagine and think that things must be the way that they are and they can't change. They definitely can, but they only will if we first imagine it and then make that imagination a reality. So highly recommend this book, Imagination, A Manifesto by Ruha Benjamin. Let's go to a commercial break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. So continuing some thoughts from the book, Imagination, A Manifesto by Ruha Benjamin. This theme of making a difference and thinking about a different world, and also the last book, especially by Dr. Benjamin, Viral Justice, about doing those small things, and the small things become the big things, and like a TikTok or like a virus, they can go viral and spread around the world. It made me think of, there's so many reasons psychologically why we don't try to change things or try to make things better. And the book touched on many of those, including those themes I discussed in the last book, the last segment, about imagination, ideas, ideologies, narratives, people in power or people who things are benefiting, making it seem like they have to be a certain way, and then them telling us what's the better future and the utopia that they're trying to build when maybe it's a dystopia. So there's a lot of those themes that came up in the book that I think were really, really important. And remind me also of Thomas Piketty's in Capital and Ideology, how he's a main thesis of the book is how throughout history there has been economic inequality, but there's always been ideologies to justify why it is okay. So in the past, he talks about things like, for example, people being born from a noble family or being descendants of being the king, let's say, and because of that, they're from God, and because of that, it makes sense for them to have a lot. And so if many people are suffering, the peasants in the field, so to speak, they should be, because they're serving the king who is from God. And so that makes sense. It should be that way. It has to be that way. And then tracing it forward to the current myths of meritocracy, where the ones who are wealthy have worked harder and smarter, and that's why they are wealthy and they deserve to be so. And if you are poor, that means you haven't worked hard or hard enough, or haven't been smart in how you've worked. And also even worse things are used to describe people who are in poverty, not recognizing that there is so many systems in place that create wealth and make wealth build and make it harder for those who don't have that wealth to pull themselves up from their bootstraps, so to speak. And by the way, that's an ironic phrase that is often used, to pull yourself up by your bootstraps, because it's not possible. I forgot which book it was, but it talked about this, how it's used so much as an adage to encourage people who are in difficult circumstances, rather than to talk about systemic changes and changes that need to happen on a larger scale, telling the individual that it's their responsibility and theirs alone to change things. But they use this metaphor of pulling yourself up from your bootstraps, but it's actually something that can't be done. So telling someone to pull themselves up by their bootstraps is almost making their argument for them that maybe something else needs to change because this is not possible. And none of this, of course, is to say that hard work doesn't matter, that people can't overcome incredibly bad circumstances and be resilient. That is all very true and very real and very important. But it doesn't mean that because of that, we, if there's inequalities, that we just accept them. I'm reminded of LeBron James' commercial a few years ago when it was talking about his own humble beginnings and showing him as a poor child in Akron and how he's become who he is now. And it's just really what he overcame. But the last line was something like, well, what if there weren't humble beginnings or something like that? But essentially emphasizing that why do we have to have any children that are born in such bad circumstances that they have to overcome them in overwhelming poverty and hardships? Why are we allowing that kind of world to exist where children have to overcome these types of odds? Why don't we make it a genuine, more level playing field where everyone is taken care of? And so a theme I wanted to touch on now related to this, what I often see happening, or one of the things that happens when people try to accept or justify an injustice, is that they'll say, well, the world isn't fair, or things aren't fair, or we can't expect them to be fair. And like many of these species arguments or ideologies, there's some truth to it, that yes, things are not fair and they're likely never going to be perfectly fair in the sense that we can say it's always fair and there's never any injustices that will happen. But that does not mean because it can't be perfectly fair, we don't strive towards justice or use that as an aspiration to make things as perfectly fair as we can, as fair as possible. Let me give you a simple example of this. So let's say there are 10 sandwiches and 10 people. And so someone says, well, each person should get one sandwich. That makes sense. But then someone says, well, actually, you know, all the sandwiches don't have the exact same amount of ingredients in them. Some of them will have a little bit more meat or bread or lettuce or other vegetables in them. So they're not really that exactly the same. So it wouldn't be perfectly fair to give one to each person. So who cares? Maybe if one person has 6 and someone else has 2 and 2 people have 1 and then everyone else has 0, that's okay because we couldn't make it perfectly fair. That would be laughable, but that's really the situation we have in the world today, where some people have too much and more than they need, and many, many, many people don't have enough to survive and to live. And so just because we can't make things perfectly fair doesn't mean we don't strive towards fairness and justice. And I think this is, of course, many things slightly about our obsession with perfection and using that as a way of getting out of things. But more than that, it's our way of getting away from the uncomfortable feelings that come up when we recognize that things are unfair and that there's injustices that we should do something about, but we're not doing enough about it. So it's easier to somehow wave away things that we see as unfair because we don't want to have to do something about it, or we're not sure if we can, or we're not sure what to do. And so I think in the last segment, I might talk about emotional homeostasis and how that impacts us in our lives and the things that we do and don't do. But it's related to this theme of because we don't feel good, we try to find a way to feel good. And so if we can't fix the problem completely to make ourselves feel good that way, we'd rather somehow pretend like there's no problem to begin with, or somehow it's okay, or somehow we're off the hook. So we feel compassion. When we feel compassion, we see the suffering or the pain of another, and through our empathy, we can feel that pain to some degree ourselves, and it doesn't feel good. I see you in pain. I can imagine what that is like, and so I hurt a bit. Now, how do I get rid of this hurt feeling? The hurt feeling is essentially guiding me to do this. You feel a pain, we try to get rid of that pain. So there are two main ways. The first one is I can help you. If I take away your suffering, well, then you'll be okay. I won't feel that pain anymore. So you are thirsty, and I see you, and your mouth is parched, and you're coughing, and you're in pain. And I bring you a cup of water. You drink that water. You say, ah, you have relief. I have relief, because now I have taken away that pain that I was feeling from having compassion for you, because now I see you're okay. I did something about it. And so in some ways, this can make us seem very selfish, even in our compassion, but really this is a lot of how human emotion works. We do feel good about certain things, but that doesn't mean it's selfish or that we'd say it's equal, because if we, I've heard this argument a lot where, well, nothing is really selfless, because even if I'm helping you, it makes me feel good, or, you know, even more than that, it might make me look good in front of other people or a bunch of other things that actually makes it good for me. So nothing is selfless. And I can get a type of argument there, but I think we have to be very careful, because if you take that argument to its extreme, then someone killing someone and someone saving someone's life are exactly doing the same thing, or morally doing the same thing, because both are selfish. The person killing feels good to kill, and the person saving a life feels good and might get praise and attention for saving the life. And so that's a very scary type of morality to have, and to create that type of a mindset. So yes, when we feel compassion, it does feel good to help others. That's not a bad thing to feed into that, to feel that goodness. We have to be aware of that, because sometimes, because it makes us feel good, we might make that the bigger part rather than the person suffering. So very important to be mindful of that. But the fact that it feels good doesn't make it a selfish thing to do, to help another person. So if I give that thirsty person some water, they drink the water, they feel good. Now I feel good. That is a relief, and I've resolved this feeling within me. But what if I can't get you water? Or what we see in the world often is, rather than that one thirsty person, there's 500,000 thirsty people who don't have enough water. Now I'm faced with a challenge, because I see the suffering, or I somehow find out about the suffering. That doesn't feel good. I can imagine what it's like to be thirsty. I'll never really know what it's like to feel that kind of thirst and not have access to water, let's say, but I can imagine it in a way that gives me a bad feeling. But then when I see I can't solve the problem, or when the problem feels unsolvable, that's where the dilemma comes up, because I can't fix the problem to feel better. And so I usually will take the other path, unfortunately, which is to make the situation okay in some way. One way that we actually will do this, we'll just ignore it. So we'll try not to look at those injustices that we don't think can be fixed, or that I can't fix or do something about. So we'll just ignore them. And that's what we're doing most of the time. All of us do this. There's suffering, injustice in the world. Most of the time we turn a blind eye or don't pay attention to it, sadly. And that's not okay. And that's what I'm trying to counteract here in myself as well, as encouraging all of us listening to think of that as well. So we usually just try to ignore it and pretend like it's not there. But we also, even if we do look at it, we will come up with ways of justifying what's going on. I talked about this actually last week too, in some ways, but one is we might blame the victim. So, well, all these people, they must have done something, you know. There's water places, they could have gotten it somehow. So they must have, why do they even live there? You know, we'll come up with some reason to blame the victim for what they're going through, even if it's something that is an injustice and should be changed. Another thing we will do is what I was alluding to earlier, say, well, the world just isn't fair. You know, just things are going to happen that are unfair no matter what we do. And maybe we'll even bring up things that happened to us that were unfair in our own lives. See, this happened to me and that happened. But that's a very weak argument, and really a very childish way of just trying to take away our bad feeling. I don't want to feel bad, so if bad things are happening, maybe bad things are just supposed to happen, that's it. Because if you say that's the case, then okay, then give all your money away and go, you know, live in some, let people beat you up, do whatever they want to you, because the world isn't fair, so why shouldn't bad things just happen to you? There really isn't a logic to saying that if bad things happen in the world, then it's okay when they happen to someone or happen to anyone. If we have the appropriate mindset that bad things should not be happening to people that can be avoided and prevented, and it's our job to reduce those, then if we see someone suffering, it is our responsibility to do something about it. And yes, will we achieve perfect justice reduce and remove all suffering in the world? No, we probably will not be able to remove all the suffering in the world. Life itself can involve suffering, just like even in the healthiest of relationships. Let's say if one person does die and the relationship ends, it's still painful. That'll still hurt, and it's pain that is part of the human experience that should be there, because that's the pain we pay for having relationships we value and care about. But should someone not have enough water to drink when we have enough water for them to drink it but are not distributing it to them? No, that is an avoidable pain, currently avoidable, not just even in the future. And that is something that we should not accept. So when we notice this tendency that we all have, a human tendency, to try to get away from a bad feeling, and one of the ways we might do it in these scenarios is to look for a way to justify the unjustifiable or to justify an injustice, recognize that in yourself, and I'm sure you'll see it in others too, but try to catch it in yourself first and foremost, because we all will do this. Something is happening. It doesn't feel good to think about the fact that it's happening, and we'll find a way to say maybe it's okay, maybe they deserved it, or maybe just the world isn't fair, so I don't have to feel bad about this. But no, I hope you still will feel bad about injustices that happen and won't let go of that pain just because it's convenient and feels better. After the break, I'll touch some more on this theme in general about emotional homeostasis. So let's go to our last commercial break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. So as I mentioned before the break, in this last segment, I'm going to talk about a concept called emotional homeostasis. Not necessarily an official term, but something that I think is quite meaningful when we try to understand the human experience. So homeostasis, you maybe have heard this term used, for example, with things like temperature, how the human body has to stay within a few degrees of temperature to be okay. And so because of that, if the body feels that it's deviating away from that, to acquire or maintain homeostasis or re-achieve that homeostasis, it will take certain actions to get us there, both internally, and even we might do behaviors to contribute to that. So for example, sweating is to try to keep your temperature from not getting too high. And this is also why fever can be dangerous, is that if your temperature goes above a certain level, it can be very unhealthy and even fatal. So homeostasis is any system that's trying to keep itself within a certain balance or a certain range. So that's homeostasis. So when I talk about emotional homeostasis, this is our emotional drive to try to maintain a balance. And really, although I'm talking about homeostasis and balancing, usually if we're feeling good, it doesn't really kick in. We're okay. Most of us are feeling really good. Maybe if we feel like we're getting too excited or hyped, we might try to calm ourselves down. But overall, we tend to go towards our positive feelings without any concern. So there's a positivity bias there. But when it comes to the homeostasis, the negative feelings will very quickly try to get us to go and try to maintain this homeostasis, get back to balance. So if we just even look at our feelings in general and try to understand why we have feelings, and we're not the only beings that have feelings. Almost all living beings have feelings in some degree. Even bacteria have feelings in the sense that they go towards and away from certain things or certain environments based on what they detect. And so this is the most fundamental way, or one fundamental way of understanding our feelings, is either to go towards something or go away from it. Humans, we could say, are much more nuanced, where it's not just positive and negative, go away, go towards, but essentially all emotions can be broken down into these valences, positive or negative, go towards, go away. And then also the intensity, high and low, is another part. So it's a very basic way of breaking down our feelings. Is it positive or negative? And how positive or negative? How intense is it? That can give us these two dimensions of how we feel. So all of our feelings are about that. And so if we have a positive feeling, it would make sense that we wouldn't need to come back to homeostasis or feel this urge to come back towards homeostasis, because we want to go towards that. And of course, if we go towards just good feelings, that can get us into a lot of problems. Maybe I'll touch on that depending on how time goes. But when we feel something bad, it will make us want to go away from that bad feeling, whether we can avoid it or to resolve something. In the previous segment, I was talking about thirst. You feel thirsty, and it's a qualitatively different pain or discomfort from other feelings. You know how to make that better. You go drink some water. You feel some relief. You've achieved both a physical homeostasis, but it also came with an emotional feeling that now this is now been brought back to balance and you feel okay. So that's a general overview of this concept or theme. And now when you recognize this or you're aware of it, you see how often this concept is playing a big role in what we do, how we communicate. So much of our life can be explained or understood with this lens. So for example, you're talking to a friend and you say, oh yeah, lost my job last week. It's like, oh man, I'm so sorry to hear that. And you'll feel it from both people, this tendency, this urge to end that topic before you move on to something else with something good, at least. It's like, oh, I lost my job. Oh man, so sorry to hear that. Yeah. Well, you know, yeah, I'm going to find something. It's going to be okay. And they're somehow rounding it out. Let's bring it back to good before we move on. Now, sometimes you might not necessarily feel good, but it's a way of putting it in a good place before we feel like we can move on. And so you'll notice this almost like a yin-yang, positive-negative play out very often. If you say something is really bad, very often someone will say something good about that thing. Sometimes it feels bad because we don't think they're empathizing with us, but often it's this tendency to just bring things to this good place, you know? So it's like something's not feeling good. We don't feel good. We are instinctively trying to bring things back to a place where they are okay, where they're not bad. So you see this very often in how people converse with one another, in how conversations can go, in how we deal with decisions in our life. In the previous segment, I was talking about even things like something bad is happening in the world. We hear about people suffering. It's like, you know, there's all these kids who are facing poverty in the United States. That doesn't feel good. You can feel this pull towards make things positive, make things feel okay. Oh, you know, well, not everyone can have a mansion or, you know, I think that example is in this book today. Not everyone could live in a mansion or not everyone can have everything. So it's okay. Or, you know, kids are so strong. They find a way. They get used to it. They're not even used to having things or being in comfort. So we find a way, or we try to find a way to get away from that bad feeling because it doesn't feel good. And so instinctively we want to go away from it. And this is what I'm trying to encourage us to be mindful of, because if we don't think about it, we will almost unconsciously come to this place where we'll often go away from reality and what's really going on, go away even from things that matter because we want to feel okay. And this is also why I think one of the biggest markers of mental health, maybe you think, okay, what's the biggest sign of mental health? You might think happiness. If you're happy and feel good, that's a sign of mental health. Or being very calm, that's a sign of mental health. And those can be both very important ones. But one that I think gets underappreciated often is what we can call either our distress tolerance or pain tolerance and emotional pain, frustration tolerance. But essentially, how good are we at tolerating feeling bad? So it can seem a bit counterintuitive when we think of mental health and we think we want to be happy. But a big marker of our mental health, an indicator of our mental health, is how well can I tolerate feeling bad? When something bad happens, how do I react to that? Unfortunately, most of us got the message growing up, because our parents themselves didn't have a lot of tolerance for negative feelings, that feeling bad is a really, really bad thing. It's a crisis. Sometimes I even think of the word crisis instead of C-R-I-S-I-S, C-R-Y-S-I-S, that anytime someone cries, it looks, people look at it like it's a crisis. So kid is crying. It's like, okay, what do we do? Give him that. Do something, because we have to just get rid of the crying as soon as possible. It's the only thing that matters. Because what's happening is the kid is crying. Of course, it's not going to make you feel good, but we can't tolerate that not good feeling ourselves. And we feel this urge, this this just frantic feeling that we have to get rid of their bad feeling. And so we are taught from a very young age that feeling bad is very bad. And anytime you're feeling bad, by all means necessary, get away from that. Whatever you have to do, whether it's ignore it somehow, if that's possible, whether it's give yourself whatever treat you need to feel better, that's just what we're going to do. We're going to find our way out of it. And what does that even sound like as I say it? But it's something we do. Give yourself whatever treat you need to feel better. That's like turning towards drugs and alcohol and also other behaviors that we do to just escape the feeling as quickly as you can. So if we are internalizing this message that feeling not good, feeling bad is really bad and scary and dangerous, then it does feel like, well, you should do whatever it takes to get yourself feeling out of it. If the house is burning, you don't mind if you pour water on the most expensive things in the house or the best things in the house because you're trying to prevent a disaster, a catastrophe. And so if we're feeling like anytime we feel bad, it is a catastrophe, well, then it doesn't matter what you do or what you have to do. Just get the heck away from that feeling. And this is really problematic and something that parents want to be very aware of in how we respond to our kids, what we call negative emotions, when they're crying or angry or whatever the feeling might be, that we don't ignore it or we don't pretend like we don't care. We want to be warm and empathic in our response, but we also don't want to give the feeling that we are really worried or freaked out by how they're feeling. And if we panic, that's going to make them feel even worse. But often parents do panic. Their kid is crying like, okay, well, stop crying. They're just giving this message that this is something really bad. I can't handle it. You can't handle it. I don't know if it's going to get better. All these bad messages rather than, oh, you feel bad. I feel bad too that you feel bad. Let me come here. Let's see if we can feel better slowly. Gradually, you're going to feel better. I know you will feel better. How you feel is not, doesn't feel good, but it's okay. You're going to be okay. And give this message of comfort and calm and hope that we will get through this, you will get through this, and you will together learn how to soothe ourselves gently, slowly. Doesn't mean you quickly will feel better, but you will feel better. That's a much better message than we got to get rid of this pain immediately. And so as adults, we carry this with us, this feeling about how okay or not okay it is and the tools to help ourselves get through not feeling bad. Do I just turn to whatever, from a bad substance to unhealthy behavior, or do I seek calming myself down, maybe a connection with someone to slowly calm me down? And this is always the issue with drugs. They work in the sense that they make you feel very good very quickly, but that's actually the problem. The fact that they work so quick is what can lead to them becoming addictive. Something that works very slowly is less likely to be addictive. If you talk to a friend and it slowly calms you down a little bit, that could feel good and reinforce you doing it, but you don't become addicted to it in that same way, unless you feel like you can't handle it on your own and you're so panicked and feel that the only way I can feel better is someone else. That could be problematic. But in general, things that slowly make us feel better are actually much better for us because of that. It's a paradox. Of course, it feels better to feel better fast. But if we can feel better slowly, that's likely a healthier way of addressing or approaching whatever it might be we're dealing with. So we have to actually get good at feeling bad. We have to get good at feeling bad. And so if we can do that, we'll be better at resisting this knee-jerk reaction of homeostasis, that if I feel bad, I have to somehow feel good. Whether someone else is telling me something, whether I'm feeling something, whether I'm thinking something. And if we want to be actually more realistic with ourselves and with the world, we have to tolerate feeling bad if we're looking at what's happening. And sometimes things will make us feel bad, sometimes they'll make us feel good. But let ourselves feel both and stay with both, rather than think we have to quickly respond to get ourselves out of that bad feeling, to make sure I'm feeling okay. So as I was mentioning in the previous segment, when we see something happening in the world that isn't good, isn't fair, there's a knee-jerk reaction to come back to homeostasis. I don't feel good about this. How do I feel okay? But that's what I was saying before, that I'd hope you keep feeling bad about it. If something is unjust, you use that feeling to do something about it. But if you pacify yourself to the injustice, then you will become passive and doing nothing about it. You won't keep taking action. So our feelings are fuel. They can drive us towards doing good things. They can drive us towards going away from things that are bad. But we have to also be able to tolerate that just because we're doing something towards making things better, it doesn't mean that bad feeling will go away. If you are trying to address a big injustice in the world, you have to accept that if you keep facing that issue, hopefully you see some progress, you see some things happening, but overall, things won't change very quickly, likely, and so you have to be ready to tolerate feeling bad in order to make a good impact. We're actually out of time, so I'll wrap up there. Big thank you to Farhuda here in the studio. You've been listening to In Session with Dr. Farid Al-Aqwi. Zan Zendegi Azadi.